Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
So we received multiple 911 calls on the night that he went missing. And it started out with a neighbor calling 911 who was immediately next door saying that there was somebody at her house knocking on the door and yelling that he needed help. She recognized him as Matthew. And while she was on the phone with 911, he ran out into a major highway, Old 99, which is in front of both of their houses. And then we started getting 911 calls from people on the roadway saying that he was in the roadway. So that was how traffic was having to stop for him, and that was how we were first made aware of this situation.
20-year-old Matthew Anfelt disappeared from his mom's house in Tenino, Washington, on the evening of February 28, 2019. Matthew had spent the day with his sister and her boyfriend. The three went out bowling together earlier in the day. Videos his sister took show Matthew smiling and laughing. They returned to their mom's home, and Matthew spent more time chatting with his sister. Everything seemed normal. Matthew got up to get his cell phone and never came back to his sister's room. Within minutes, she heard sirens outside and came to learn that several people had witnessed Matthew's sudden, panicked behavior nearby. Dispatchers began getting more calls about Matthew from a speedway a couple miles down the road. By the time they got there, Matthew was gone, never to be seen again. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 245 of The Vanished, part 2 of Matthew Anfelt's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. In part one of Matthew's story, you learned about his life, struggles, and how he disappeared one cold evening in February of 2019. In this second installment, we're going to learn more about the search efforts for Matthew, hear from the detective working his case, and try to unravel the mystery of what happened. We had the opportunity to speak with Detective Mickey Hamilton, who was currently investigating Matthew's disappearance. He told us more about his background in law enforcement.
I'm Detective Mickey Hamilton with the Thurston County Sheriff's Office. I've been a detective here since 2019, and prior to working with the sheriff's office, I worked for the city of Flagstaff, Arizona, as a police officer there. And what interested me in law enforcement was just when I was in college, I was looking for a major and found criminal justice and took a few criminal justice classes, and I really liked them. And so that's kind of how I got started in criminal justice or in law enforcement.
Detective Hamilton explained that after they received the 911 calls about Matthew's bizarre behavior, that this all started as a welfare check to make sure he was okay, and later evolved into a missing persons case.
In the beginning, it was a welfare check to find out what he needed help with and what was going on that he was stopping traffic for, or what was his problem, and we were just going to check on him and try to help with whatever was going on. We start trying to find him immediately. And it's a case-by-case basis, depending on the circumstances surrounding that case. But typically, They're going to be entered into the NCIC, the National Missing Person Database, and then we'll start trying to figure out where they're at based on the information that's given to us by the people who reported them missing or the people that know them or last had contact with them or whatever that case may be. So patrol deputies responded immediately out to that area of the house. And so as the 911 calls continue to come in on Old 99, eventually Matthew ends up a couple miles south of his house on Old 99 at a small convenience store called the Speedway Grocery. And the clerk there called 911 because he ran into the store there saying that his family had been murdered and he needed help. And she says, okay, I'll call 911 for you. Just calm down. While she's on the phone with 911, he runs out the back door of the grocery store out into the area there. And that was the last time anybody had seen him. So the patrol deputies go to his house to confirm that his family hasn't been murdered. His sister's there. She's okay. She doesn't know anything about any of this. She later told me that everything seemed normal. And then a deputy shows up in the driveway and is asking her if she's okay, and she doesn't know what's going on. So deputies begin searching the area for him. They're concerned about excited delirium because he is reported to have some blood coming out of his mouth. They don't know if that's bloody nose or bit his lip or bust lip or what, but that was one of the reports was that he was bleeding from the mouth. He had no shoes on. Clothing, he just had a sweatshirt and sweatpants, but it was the end of February, first night of March, and it got down into the high 20s, I believe, that night. So it was cold. So it was odd behavior, and overheating is one of those signs of excited delirium. And so that was their concern. So they're trying to find him as fast as they can. So multiple deputies go through that area up and down those streets where he was last seen running from. And that's a fairly rural area. Most of those properties are at least 1 acre and bigger. There's a large equestrian center across the street from this address that is hundreds of acres, maybe. There's another game preserve or wildlife preserve that's between his house and this grocery, which is 100+ acres. So there's a lot of wooded area out there, too. So deputies start trying to find him in all this area. We also expected more 911 calls to come in because he's generating 911 calls as he goes along because of his erratic behavior. However, after that Speedway grocery, there was no more 911 calls. He didn't have his phone. He didn't have his wallet. He just had nothing on him. But deputies kind of expected that, well, he's just either having some kind of a mental episode, or when they can't find him, they assume he got picked up maybe by a friend, and they tell his family, well, we can't find him. They looked throughout the night, and he'll probably just come home when he sobers up or calms down or whatever's going on. Well, his mom calls the next morning and says he still never came home. And at that point, they take a missing persons report.
Detective Hamilton mentioned interviewing Matthew's sister, Cheyenne. While reading over his notes from that interview, certain things stood out. She recalled the events of the day. They had gone bowling together. She mentioned that Matthew had told her that he had stayed up for 3 days straight as some sort of internet challenge. He showed her that he had been constantly posting on social media over the course of those 3 days in order to prove that he was awake the whole time. She told him he was crazy for doing that. After they returned from the bowling alley, they hung out in her room chatting. He remarked several times about how tired he was. He then got up to get his phone, and that was the last time she saw Matthew. She didn't see him take any drugs or consume alcohol during the course of the day she spent with him prior to his disappearance. He was gone for several minutes, and she didn't think much of it. She just figured he had passed out on the couch after being up for 3 days, since he kept saying how tired he was. When she eventually went to look for Matthew, this is when the police began arriving on scene. With all leads continuing to come up empty, about 3 weeks after Matthew went missing, the detective decided to return to the area where Matthew was last seen. He got permission to search a 130-mile tract of land that is between the Speedway and Sarah's home, with dogs, ground searchers, and unmanned aerial devices. 4 dog teams came out that day, along with ground searchers, and all they found was a black beanie cap. After further inspection, they determined that it didn't belong to Matthew. Detective Hamilton told us more about the physical search efforts for Matthew.
I did get search and rescue out there in that area with about a week after this occurred, and we had 4 canine teams on one day and 4 to 6 canine teams. I'd have to look at the report, but about a month later, and we searched that whole area with cadaver dogs. We searched it again with ground searchers in the big wooded areas where we had hundreds of acres to cover. We searched it with drones. I mean, we did 3 searches out there, and I really expected to find him burrowed in some dark hole somewhere where he was trying to get out of the weather or get cooled off or hide from the people that he was running from in his mind, but we didn't find him. And then I expected hunters to find him the following fall when there would be hunters out in all those woods, and so far they haven't found him either. So it's very bizarre case.
Still looking for more leads, Detective Hamilton checked in with Matthew's employer, which was actually a temp agency. Sarah told us in part one that Matthew seemed stressed over money, and the agency confirmed that he worked for them and was well-liked by many. But he hadn't gotten a temp position since January 28th, a full month before he disappeared. And the last time he had checked in for work was February 26th, 2 days before he disappeared. But they didn't have any work for him that day. They also told the detective that Matthew was paid with a prepaid Visa cash card that was loaded with his earnings. Unfortunately, he left that card behind at his mom's. So if he was out there alive, he wouldn't have access to whatever funds were left after a month of not working. In part one, Sarah expressed her frustrations about how they can't get search warrants in Matthew's case, because there's no evidence of a crime. Detective Hamilton addressed those concerns and explained how missing adult cases can be tricky to investigate with no evidence that a crime has been committed.
At this point, it's just, it's very puzzling. And that's another issue we've run into when I've talked to his mother, because she wants to get search warrants for this place or search warrants for that place or search warrants for phones. And I've tried to explain to her that, well, you have to have a crime in order to have a search warrant, because you're searching for evidence of a crime. And in this case, we've got no evidence that a crime occurred. So it's kind of a strange place to be in. And it's frustrating for her. And I understand that she's not familiar with the criminal justice system, but it is a difficult position to be in with all missing person cases, because as an adult, you have the legal right to go missing if you want to. However, we try to make sure people are okay, and now we're in this weird place where it's gray area of, is there a crime? Is there a reason for police to be involved? Or is this person just gone because they want to be gone? It's frustrating for the family because they see things on TV, you know, and people are found within one episode, and they have all kinds of resources brought to bear on different cases or whatever. And so people have the high expectations of what we are able to do compared to reality. And it can be frustrating for them when they actually experience it, and it's not quite as easy as it's made to seem sometimes. It's difficult. And, you know, we have several unsolved missing person cases, and they're all frustrating for different reasons.
One theory about what could have happened to Matthew is that he had a sudden mental break, whether that was drug-induced or not. As I mentioned in part one, we received an extensive file on Matthew from the Thurston County Sheriff's Office. One thing they uncovered was that before he disappeared, Matthew was expressing beliefs in conspiracy theories he was reading online. It's unclear if this could point to a fragile mental state, but they found that he began believing in a group called the Illuminati and their relation to famous people. Matthew had debated the idea of joining the Illuminati because of his dreams of being a famous rapper. He believed that this could help him achieve that goal. He read online that if he sold his soul to Satan, after signing the contract, the Illuminati would make him famous. After he disappeared, going through his emails, they found that he was in communication with someone with the email address Illuminati666@Hotmail. Just a couple of weeks before he went missing, Matthew sent these people $300, and they sent him an initiation code that also mentioned a task that Matthew had to complete. However, no task was stated in the email. To most of us, this sounds ridiculous, and the detective believed that this was just an internet scam to exploit people for financial gain. Despite how ridiculous this whole thing sounded, the detective investigated the lead and found nothing of substance behind it. Just another scam. Matthew had also posted an Instagram video of himself rapping about the Illuminati. The lyrics talked about having to give up his family and everything he owned to be famous, and the chorus went on to say, "Should I do it? I don't know." Was all of this talk about the Illuminati some kind of fantasy that Matthew had, or did he really believe in this? One thing that we may be able to take away from this Illuminati situation is that while any of us can fall victim to internet scams, could this particular one tell us anything about Matthew's mental health in the lead-up to going missing? Could he have been declining and it wasn't overly noticeable until the day he disappeared? Detective Hamilton told us about the various theories that have been circulating about what happened to Matthew and what evidence he has found to support these various theories.
He had been involved in some drug use. And so there's been some talk with different people about whether or not his drug use was related to his disappearance, if he possibly owed somebody money or those kinds of things that typically go along with the drug trade. Most of every tip I've gotten has turned out to just be kind of hearsay and rumor. And somebody heard something from this group of friends that he went to high school with or knew him. And I haven't been able to substantiate any claims that anyone intentionally made him go missing. As far as his own intentions, he hadn't made any plans known to anyone that he was intending to leave town or he was intending to go anywhere. So we have no indication that he intentionally went missing himself. So that kind of leads us to this idea that he unintentionally went missing due to some kind of psychotic break or drug use or combination thereof.
There is also this whole other scenario with Matthew's case, and that it could be related to this prior attack on him in the months leading up to his disappearance. Detective Hamilton gave us his perspective on that attack.
So he reported to his mother that he was assaulted in December 2018 on his way home from work. And he reported that to a couple of his friends too. I've gotten different indications about where this assault occurred. His mother believed that it occurred in Lacey, at least. One other friend believed it occurred in Lacey, but I have another friend who believed that it occurred in Tumwater. His mother took pictures of the assault because it was fairly violent and he had some significant injuries from it. And even though he didn't want to report it, she felt like it should be documented just in case something else comes of it. So she provided me the pictures of his injuries. Other than that, he told her he either didn't know who did it or didn't want to tell her who did it. It's kind of unclear. And as far as the other people I've talked to, he didn't name any suspects and said, "This is the person that assaulted me." He made some inferences and they made some assumptions. So I've gotten ideas about maybe who could possibly be involved. But again, I haven't come across any hard evidence to say for sure who was involved in that or even what it was about. He told his mom it was a random attack, but they actually cut him and carved some words on his body. That doesn't seem very random at all. But that was his claim to his mom, that he didn't know who these people were and this was a random attack and they were just trying to jump him for, I don't know. It doesn't fit with the crime patterns in that area. It doesn't fit with even what his mom knows about things. So his mom also believed that this was not a random attack, but for whatever reason, he was afraid of these people and wouldn't tell her. So that's what I know about the assault. I believe the assault occurred in December, but we tried investigating it after he went missing. And so it's trying to investigate a crime where your victim is now gone and it's several months old, at least 4 months old by the time I started looking into it. So most of the businesses that I tried to contact didn't have any security camera video going back that far. And so it's very difficult to investigate that and to try and determine if it's tied to his disappearance now. It's definitely suspicious that he was assaulted in December 2018, and then he goes missing at the end of February, beginning of March. But I don't know, it could be related or it might not be because there's such limited information about it.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. There remains the possibility that Matthew did relapse and took some type of drug on the day he disappeared, and that could have caused the panic state he was exhibiting. We wanted to learn more about his drug history and what he may have taken on that day.
It was probably right around 15, 16. He started off with marijuana, and then he progressed a little bit with the alcohol, and then I started finding out about what they call chlorocetin pills. I guess the drug world calls them triple C's, and they are, from what I understand, a blood pressure cold medicine. You can just buy it. He would tell me it's like $5 a box.
Chlorocetin is an over-the-counter cold medicine, and their formula is designed for people with high blood pressure. And when taken at a high dose, the user experiences a high. Abusing this drug can be popular amongst teens since it's fairly easy to get, although several years ago, measures were put in place to make it harder to obtain, like putting the product behind the pharmacy counter. With many states requiring identification to purchase and prohibiting the sale of the drug to minors. For Matthew, chlorocetin was not the only drug he used, but it was an easy one to get his hands on.
From Matthew's perspective, you know, he was pretty much an open book with me. He would talk to me a lot. Sometimes he tried, you know, play the normal, I'm not doing this. But usually he'd end up breaking down, telling me everything. That was probably his main drug of choice and drinking. So he would tell me it's like a clean drunk, whatever that means. I have no idea. He later really got away from the marijuana. And then if he couldn't get his hands on that, then I know that he was doing other things. So I know he got into meth for a little bit, but really his drugs of choices were pills. So I knew that he would do. There was one he would get at school, he told me, Adderall. So Adderall, the triple C's or chlorocetin pills, those were his main drugs of choice.
We wanted to learn more about chlorocetin, how it affects the brain, and why so many young people abuse it. We spoke to Dr. William Clay Brown.
My name is William Clay Brown. I am board-certified physician in addiction medicine, family practice. Been in the addiction field a little over 20 years. Got interested in that through some personal experience and family member experiences with drug addiction.
Dr. Brown told us more about chorasetin.
Chorasetin is actually used as a cough medicine. It contains dextromethorphan, which is the active ingredient that works to suppress the cough. It works actually in the brain to suppress the cough center through what's called a sigma receptor. But it's also classified as a dissociative anesthetic. It actually is in the same drug class as PCP and ketamine. Dextromethorphan, active ingredient chorasetin in high doses, does very similar things. It has some physiologic addictive properties. It depletes some of the dopamine in the brain, kind of like an amphetamine, more or less, so that if someone is taking it regularly in large amounts, it's kind of like their brain thermostats reset because they've depleted some of the neurotransmitters in their brain. And if they quit taking it, there may be some mild withdrawal symptoms like depression for a few days, some anxiety, but mainly it's a craving phenomenon because it's super physiologically stimulated their brain to use up some of its neurotransmitters. So until those neurotransmitters can be resynthesized and replenished in the brain misses it, for lack of a better term. It doesn't have a withdrawal syndrome like opiates or like alcohol, where there's seizures and nausea, vomiting, and everything else that goes along with alcohol withdrawal or opiate withdrawal. But there is a mild withdrawal syndrome. But typically, the psychological craving for the drug and for its effects is what makes it addictive. But I've treated a lot of patients, mainly adolescents and young adults, 18, 19, 20 years old. It's a highly used drug because it's available over the counter and people can steal it or buy it from drugstores. And then what they do is take way more than is prescribed or than is recommended. Sometimes, you know, as much as 10 or 15 times as a normal dose would be 30 milligrams or one pill, and they take 10 or 15 pills at once. They get some stimulation and euphoria, mild hallucinations. Or as they take more, they can get into more serious psychological and behavioral effects like total disorientation, loss of coordination, inability to walk, to feeling depersonalized, which when they don't see themselves in reality, they don't see themselves as a separate entity existing in reality. They kind of just blend into their surroundings. Or at least that's what their brain tells them. And then if they keep taking it, they can really get bad. They can get really high temperatures and actually go into a coma, have really high blood pressure, usually require hospitalization.
Dr. Brown also explained some of the potential side effects of long-term abuse of this drug.
They can actually become psychotic. If they take enough dextromethorphan often enough, it can produce a psychosis, which is not, it's the next level from dissociation. I mean, it's actual manic acting or paranoid schizophrenia acting, resembling those type of disorders with long-term use. And some of that is residual. I don't personally know of any cases where it's been permanent, but sometimes if these young people have used a lot of dextromethorphan or chorasetin, over a prolonged period of time, like every day for weeks on end, it takes them sometimes 6 to 8 weeks to kind of get back to baseline. Generally, they're very anxious, very withdrawn. Typically, they end up, if they're in treatment, they end up on antipsychotic medication, mood stabilizing medication, and antidepressant medication. But most of them, the vast majority, over 2 to 3 months, if they stay off of it, and if they're getting some help and some treatment, tend to normalize or get back to the baseline. Like I said, most of these kids strike me as kids that have some underlying psychiatric or psychologic personality issues anyway. Once you say you get them in treatment and you get them off of mind-altering chemicals or illicit and mind-altering chemicals anyway, and you get them stabilized on meds, they're hard to treat because you get them back to a baseline, which includes some behavioral or psychiatric issues. They may not be horrible. They may not be psychotic, but issues that fuels their desire to go back and use some more dextromethorphan to basically to change the way they feel. The biggest misconception that the kids have is that it's harmless, you know, and that they can just go take these things 10 or 12, 15, 20 at a time and have their trip and then come out of it and do it again without harming themselves. They're not able to recognize that, you know, it's doing some damage psychologically and within their body and their brain. And so that's a big misconception they have. I don't think it's something that parents are really clued into. So there may be some misconceptions that, you know, if your kid's taking some cough medicine occasionally to get a buzz, it's really not going to hurt them too much, because it can get pretty serious. The other thing is that it's not a controlled substance, so it can't be that strong. It can't be that bad. It can't be that unsafe, because you can buy it at the drugstore over the counter. So I think that kind of reinforces, especially young people, that, you know, it's quote unquote safe to use. And the other thing is, you know, they get in this, you do develop some resistance to the dose. So if they're using a lot of it regularly, and 10 pills might have gotten where they needed to be or produced the desired effect, you know, the first three or four times they use it, then they think, well, maybe if I take 12, it'll do better. And then, you know, then 14. And then they end up overdosing and end up in the hospital in the intensive care unit when they push it too much over the limit. So I don't know if that's really a misconception, but it certainly happens. So, you know, definitely be on the lookout for empty boxes of cough medicine under beds, kids that have very erratic changes in their behavior.
Matthew had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, that went undiagnosed until he was older. Some of the drugs he was taking relieved the symptoms he was experiencing.
You know, I had always felt like he had some ADHD, and he got into some trouble in 2017, and it was literally like he just went off the deep end within a 30-day period. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I've got to get him in. I'd never wanted to, because he had the addiction side, right? But he would tell me the pills that he would take that were actually for ADHD. He would tell me, you know, Mom, I feel more normal on them. And I really felt like he had ADHD. So he had gotten into trouble. He had had 3 different cases within a 30-day period. 2 of them were alcohol related, and then 1 was, I believe, drug related, but he never got drug related charges. But he just got in so much trouble within a short amount of time that I was able to get him furloughed from jail to go do treatment. And I want to say it was probably the chlorocetin. He may have been dabbling with meth at that point, because he looked like death warmed over. It was very, very clear that he was doing some really bad stuff at that point. I really fought hard, given his, you know, his father's background with rehab facilities. It was very important to me to get him into a good one and not just what I call a hole in the wall type structure. When he was in jail, they wanted to just do the one in there. And I really fought to get him to go to, and you can look it up, it's called Sundown Ranch. And it's within a canyon. It's on a big piece of property. They bring the family in and get the family involved. So basically the courts they allowed it, and I was able to pick him up directly from jail, take him. Yakima is probably about 3 hours from here. So I took him there. The deal was that when he graduated from that program, he'd have to go back to jail, which was one of the toughest days, because he did so well in it, right? It was a wonderful program. And he ended up having to go back again, not from jail, obviously, but I had given them an ultimatum to try it again, or he couldn't stay with me anymore. We did take him again, and he went through the program, did well again, like most addicts, and then fell back. The way that they did things was very one-on-one, very positively done. The family would be brought in for a couple days and they had quarters for the families to stay at for a few days. So like the first time I went, it was over Thanksgiving that the family period was going on. So we got to be there for Thanksgiving with our loved ones. And, you know, they bring you one-on-one for counseling, you know, talking about addiction, talking about what it does on the brain. It was just very educational. And then they do the counseling with you and your loved one. It was very centered around what happens with an addict and why they get to that point and trying to get family to understand. And then, of course, not enabling them and the tough love that has to go along with that. I will never forget, I had been watching him deteriorate for a couple of years. And when he went to jail, that was probably, I will say, at his lowest point. And I have pictures from back then that I hate looking at because I can just see it even more now. I remember, because they have to go through a period where you don't get to talk to them, 3 hours away. So I couldn't just go over there with work and stuff. But I remember the first time that I went over there for a visitation with him and him walking out, just the weight that he'd put on and the look in his eyes. And it was amazing. I remember just when he walked out to me, I just remember bawling because it was him again. You know, he looked good. He was healthy looking. I think he did have a lot of measured success. And I know when he came out of there, he wanted more, you know, but, you know, any type of stress or any type of, and I'm not trying to make excuses for them, but they don't do well with it. They go back to that crutch. I know he had some testing after all that happened, and they did find that he had ADHD. I had gotten him on medication. He didn't like the one that they put him on because, you know, we had made sure that they knew he shouldn't have Adderall because he's got the addictive personality. But then he had started dabbling in drugs again, so I refused to keep getting them for him because we all know if you mix certain things, it can be fatal. And originally, you know, I said either my sister or I would just, you know, hand him the pills every day. But when I found out that he was dabbling again in the drug world, I said, no way. We sort of ripped that Band-Aid off again. And he kept telling me he really didn't like the one he was on, which was, I don't know. It was one that didn't, I think it might have been slow releasing. It wasn't like Adderall where you could get addicted to it. And Matthew, as angry as he knew I would get about his drug addictions and the things that he would do, a lot of times he did this stuff alone. It wasn't always around friends. And he would do it here at the house behind my back over going somewhere. And then I would figure it out. So there was a couple instances that I did see him, you know, on different drugs. And he would tell me what he had done because I would point it out. With the Corsine, I never saw him hallucinate or anything like that. I started going through his backpacks. And if I found him, I would throw him away, you know, and that was why I would go through his backpack. And that was usually the main thing that I would find. I don't think I ever found anything else. He probably really kept that stuff hidden. But the chloroquine pills, he had a hard time hiding that because he did it so much.
Matthew was very open with his mom about his addiction and explained to her the struggles he was facing.
And he used to sit and talk to me and he said, Mom, it's like a vicious cycle. You know, you want to be clean, you get clean, and then guilt overloads you of all the poor choices you've made or the people that you've hurt. And then you end up right back in there very easily. And so it's horrible. And I too have watched many people struggle with addiction, with drugs and alcohol. And it's a very sad, vicious cycle. So many people judge, but they really don't understand what it does to a person and how it changes them. And it's not something they chose. They didn't wake up and go, I want to be an addict. I want to screw up my life. And I don't even think a person that's living in that world really wants to be in that world. They just don't know how to get out of it.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. We wanted to speak with one of Matthew's friends to get a friend's perspective on Matthew's struggles with addiction. His longtime friend Kendra told us how they met and also how Matthew didn't want her to know that he was using drugs.
We met when I was a senior and he was a freshman, and we wrestled on the same wrestling team together. I used to pick on him. He was itty bitty tiny little freshman. I was a normal sized senior, and I used to pick on him all the time because he was so tiny. And then we became best friends, and we were inseparable all season long. He was just so goofy all the time. He was happy and goofy and random. Everything was always fun. He didn't care to not have fun. After high school, we kept in touch for a couple years, and then he went down a different path than I went down, and we stopped hanging out for a while, and then I got a relationship and had a baby, and then I came back, and he came back, and we ended up being really, really close again, and we were really, really close all the way up until he disappeared. I mean, we're close, but we just didn't talk as often during a certain gap of time. We were in high school together, well, not during wrestling season, of course, but I mean, we smoked weed together and stuff. But he hid everything else from me. I didn't know about any of it until he got put on blast about it and somebody told me about it. He hid it all from me. He was disappointed in himself for it and didn't want me to know about it. Felt like there was more to him than that. There always has been and always will be more to him than any kind of addiction. He was always seemed so good. He just wanted to hang out with a certain crowd and got sucked into their bullshit or got manipulated into it. I don't know. He knows when to follow to keep himself out of trouble, but he's pretty independent. He was usually a leader. He's just an all-around good person. As stubborn as he was and as goofy as he was, he never wanted anybody else to feel the pain he'd felt or the pain he was feeling or just in pain in general. If somebody was going down his path, he'd tell them to run the opposite direction. He was always trying to get out of it himself.
Sarah believes that Matthew's disappearance has some connection to the drug world. whether he relapsed or someone was after him.
I do believe it's drug-related. I do believe that, you know, whether someone was after him or he was on drugs, there's something very significant that happened that day. What happened that day was not Matthew. Matthew was not one to go on bingers. You know, I've known drug addicts that did bingers. Matthew was not that person to go and disappear for days on end. He just wasn't. If I wanted him to get a hold of me, he would call me. I just don't believe that he just left. And I know it's possible. And I hope to God he's just out there. But what I know of my son, and most people will tell you that, it just isn't him to not contact his family, at least his closest friends. I struggle with him being alive because I just know him. And for me, it's too coincidental that 2 months before this, he had been attacked. He was scared about his family's safety then.
Matthew's great-grandmother Shirley told us that she doesn't know what could have happened to him. But one thing she's certain of is that Matthew wouldn't have gone this long without contacting his loved ones.
I just truly feel very strongly that Matthew was struggling very, very hard to get his life on track. And I know that's what he wanted really bad. I feel very strongly that his love for his family was fantastic. I mean, he would never go away without being in touch with his mother. And I feel even me, if he could, I just pray daily that either he will come back or we will know what has happened to him. For it is very, very painful not knowing if there is a chance that he's been done away with. I'm trying to prepare myself for that. And when I let my dog out in the morning and there's a certain star in a certain spot that is always shining, and I look up there and I'll say, "Good morning, Matthew, I love you." And if he could hear that, I just want him to know that his great-grandma Shirley misses him tremendously. I just wish that whoever knows would come forth. I know they know something because of the circumstances that he left on, disappeared in. Really, it's devastating. And I can't believe he could leave, just run away like that because of what happened to him in December before that. Because I know when he did come to the Christmas after he got beat up and he had black eyes, and I knew something was up. But they always try to keep things from me, because particularly Matthew, because he was so afraid that I would have a heart attack. I couldn't even realize I was a tough old bird. But anyway, I asked him what happened. Oh, he said, "Oh, Grandma, I was riding my bicycle and I hit something and fell over it." Well, I let it go because he evidently didn't want to give me the full details. And then later, it was a couple weeks later, I was there and I wanted to go to a church that he had gone to, and I knew he was really interested in it, and so was his mother. And so we went, and I don't know how the conversation come up now, but I know he needed some money or something, and I had a little extra on me. So I said, "Okay." And I said, "But, you know, I really feel it's time you start telling me the truth. You and your mother both, I've got to know what is going on." And so he did. He told me that he'd been beat up. And of course, I had found out about the writing on his chest. And I gave him the money. And he goes, "Grandma, I'll make sure you get it back." I just don't like the people he was associating with. And I've gotten to know a lot more of them now. But I do feel very strongly that Matthew had two sets of friends. One set of friends, he was not a very nice set, evidently, and he never talked about it. And I know after he got beat up, he tried to hide not being frightened, but you could tell he was. I don't know what to say or how to describe it, except, as you know, after you get older and go through life, you can see and know things and feel things without being told. And of course, too, the young people look at you as, oh, well, you're old fashioned and you don't know. And you do know. I just get very angry when I know there's people out there that know they don't talk. But then on the other hand, maybe they're afraid to. But that's not easing our pain any.
When we spoke with Matthew's friend, Kendra, she explained how she came to find out that he was missing, and also the theories that she's considered about what may have happened to her friend.
I live with Sarah. So the night that he disappeared, Sarah and I both didn't come straight home that night. Usually we all just come home, make dinner, do our thing. Well, Sarah had plans with her friends, and I had plans with another side of my family that they all wanted to have dinner. And so I went there and she went to her place and I'm waiting for my food and Cheyenne calls me and she's like, Kendra, Matthew's gone. There's cops everywhere. I don't know what to do. I'm like, what? She goes, I don't know what to do. I need you to come home. So I left my kid with the family and I came home and I was pissed. I was so angry. I kept saying, I'm going to whoop his ass when he gets here. I'm going to whoop his ass when he comes back. 2 days later, he still hadn't come back, and the anger was gone, and all that was left was fear and sadness. At first, I just thought that he was running from somebody, or that maybe he inherited his dad's schizophrenia and was thinking he needed to run from somebody and didn't know what in, you know, reality from not reality. And so I just, like, kept telling myself he just got to have schizophrenia. That's got to be it. That's right. He's not here right now. He's got to be thinking that his family's hurt and he's hallucinating all this when he's not. He just doesn't know reality from fiction, nonfiction from fiction. And as time went on and we learned more, I realized that it probably had to do with other people being involved. That is why he never came back. I want to believe that he'll come home, but the rest of me thinks that he was killed and that he's not coming home.
Sarah and her family have spent a lot of time going over every little detail of Matthew's case, going back over the things that happened in the days and weeks prior. She feels like there is something more at play here.
Because one of the things my daughter said, too, that she was concerned about is the fact that he showed back up at the house 2 days prior, right after I had taken him home. And I know from the friends that dropped him off that night, I wonder if there's more to this than what I know. But they said that Matthew was very upset that night. They were very worried about his state of mind because he was really beating himself up about the choices in his life. And obviously, you know, I get concerned, what's he telling them? That he was scared. Was he, and now they're scared to tell us that. Because the one consistent thing that we've been told by a lot of people are scared to talk. They want to talk, but they're scared. We get some information, but it's never enough. One individual took off out of state. Thank God the detective had made it to his house when he was packing, but he was ready to take off. And he did for a short period of time. And people began to talk a little bit when he was gone, and then he came back. You know, and I don't know if he was at fault, but I think there's a lot of compelling stuff that we've learned to say that he probably knows a little bit more than what he's saying. Then we had another name, and then it's just, and there's nothing you can do. Like, I even at one point was like, hey, you know, these are drug dealers. Go after them. Get them off the street. And I was told, well, we don't have the drugs. Well, no, but you have enough people saying that they're dealing drugs. And I think it's a much bigger picture because one of the things I do want to say is that what I have found through this is that, so my son went to Tumwater High School and most of these kids are around my son's age and people are scared of some of these kids. And I got to tell you, I don't believe that they're the head honchos. You know, no 20, 21-year-old is running this show. And for whatever reason, Tumwater has been targeted. And I mean, it's huge. And I've told the detective, I said, I think this is bigger than what we even know. I think this goes much deeper than these 20-year-olds. And if anything comes out of this, I really hope that's what's taken out, is whatever's going on with the Tumwater area, because it's very sad. I'm angry, but I also feel sad for these young adults that have probably, like my son, been swooped up into this group and now don't have a choice. I hope to be part of the bigger picture in changing some of these things, because it's the family suffers. I told my kids at the vigil, one thing that said, I just want answers for them. They go through life and they miss their brother. It's not fair. It's not fair. And a part of me sometimes, because I've known other individuals that have been killed at a young age, and I think about, is God protecting me from not knowing that? I don't know that I could handle that if somebody did something really awful to him, or knowing that he suffered.
Matthew's disappearance has been tough on the whole family, but Sarah told us that it's been particularly difficult for her daughter because she was with him just minutes before this all happened.
It's very hard on them. My daughter, she's taken it the hardest. Well, I don't want to say the hardest, but she's done some self-blame. Why didn't I go to the house with them?
Detective Hamilton told us more about where Matthew's case stands today and how the lack of evidence of a crime continues to be a struggle he grapples with.
There are some people that I've talked to that his mother felt maybe had more information than they were giving. So I've talked to them, and again, I haven't found any evidence to believe that they had anything to do with his disappearance. So again, at this point, we're still kind of no persons of interest because we don't believe, or we don't have enough evidence to believe that a crime occurred. Does that make sense? I don't even know yet that we have a crime, so it's hard to have a person of interest for a crime you didn't know occurred. The thing is, are there people that were close to him in the drug trade that they could have something to do with this? Absolutely, they could, but I don't have anything to indicate that it did. And I've talked to each one of those people, and they all say they have it. Now, do I get lied to? On a daily basis, I get lied to. So that doesn't mean they're not lying to me, but I don't have a way to prove that they're lying to me, and I don't have any information at this point that's concrete information to believe a crime occurred. And everyone I talked to that knew Matthew says they liked him. Like, I can't find any enemies. Matthew's got to be out there somewhere. And he was wearing a fairly distinctive Chicago Bulls sweatshirt when he went missing. And so if people just are aware of that and can, in the area especially, be aware, along the I-5 corridor, if he did get picked up and for some reason went to Portland or went to Seattle. I had one tip where a person told me she saw him standing on the on-ramp, and he didn't look quite right, and he was asking for a ride to Seattle. But she was going east instead of north, so she gave him $10, and then she continued on her way. So there's at least one person out there who strongly believes she saw him and he was trying to go north. So if that's the case, again, no, he's not a suspect of any crime. We just need to check on him and make sure he's okay. So if anybody has seen him and they haven't said anything for whatever reason, we need to at least check on him and make sure he's okay so we can let his mother know that, because you can imagine the anguish she's been going through now for over a year of not knowing the answer to any of these questions or where her son is at. I guess the one hope, or the best possible outcome we could hope for, is that he did go to Portland or Seattle and he's just living among the homeless population and someone is supporting him. But pretty hard to stay under the radar and not even have a police contact where they're going to identify you and then see that you're a missing person. The longer we go, the more unlikely that is.
Finally, Detective Hamilton told us where to call if anyone has information about Matthew's whereabouts.
They can call Crime Stoppers or Washington's Most Wanted. Both of those places have information about him. They can call me directly. My desk phone number is 360-786-5279. We can talk, but yeah, they can absolutely remain anonymous. This is a missing person, as far as we know right now. It's not a crime, so it's not like it's going to go to court or they're going to be called to testify about anything. But they can always remain anonymous through Crime Stoppers as well, and then they don't even deal with the police directly. Crime Stoppers will give them an anonymous PIN number, and then they will pass the tip on to law enforcement. If you want to call the Thurston County Sheriff's Office, the non-emergency number is 360-704-2740. If you want to call me directly, Detective Hamilton, my phone number is 360-786-5279.
So what happened to Matthew Anfelt on that cold February night in 2019 when he ran out of his home in a panic and showed up on a neighbor's doorstep? We know that Matthew had been clean for a period of time leading up to his disappearance, but he was struggling with feelings of failure and worries about how he would pay his bills. Was he unable to cope with those feelings and relapsed? If he did use drugs, did that lead him to have some kind of drug-induced mental break? If he didn't use any drugs, did he have a mental health event after staying up for 3 days as part of an internet challenge? And what about the attack that happened months earlier, when he said he was jumped by a group of guys? Could that have any connection to his disappearance? The witnesses who saw him that night all described that he seemed genuinely terrified. Was that because someone was actually after him, or did he just believe that to be true? Matthew Anfelt was last seen on February 28, 2019, in the area of the Speedway on Old Highway 99 in Grand Mound, Washington. He was wearing a black and gray Chicago Bulls sweatshirt and gray sweatpants. He was not wearing any shoes and didn't have a phone. If you live in this area, the Sheriff's Department asks that you check your property and any outbuildings you may have. Matthew was 20 years old and described as 5'7" tall, weighing about 120 pounds. If you have any information about the disappearance of Matthew Anfelt, please contact Detective Hamilton at 360-786-5279. You can follow Matthew's story on Facebook at Help Find Matthew Anfelt.
When he first went missing, I was able to watch his music videos and old wrestling videos, and it made me feel better. And it's gotten to a point where I have pictures of him all over the place, and it's very hard to even see those pictures. No matter what, if the sheriff shows up at my house and tells me my son is dead, it's going to crush me. But I don't want to be that parent that's like, oh, they're out there. And then that happens. And then, you know, it's even worse on me because I didn't want to see the reality of the situation. You have no closure. I can't bury him. I don't know if he's going to walk up into my life. The only hope I have, because I don't have him and I don't know, but at any point that could change. You're always on edge. You're always trying, you know, what have I missed? What have I done? It's insane. And then you get to a point where you feel like your hands are tied behind your back and you may never know. And I don't want to fully reach that. I feel like we've got enough that we could, but it's tough just the way the laws are written, and it's tough to move these cases forward.
That brings us to the end of episode 245. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Ohio. Thanks for listening.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loureau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.